Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You ever been there when an uncomfortable question about race comes up, but you don't know how to answer? That's where Code Switch lives. Each week, we're talking about race and how it intersects with every other aspect of your life, from politics and pop culture to history and food. Listen now to the Code Switch podcast from NPR.
Hey, it's Matea, reminding you that this show cannot be made without you. If you've been thinking about becoming a Canada Land supporter, we're having a pretty great sale right now. You'll get premium ad-free feeds of all Canada Land shows, discounts on merch from our store, and exclusive bonus episodes, like a behind-the-scenes tour of the federal budget lockup, more of Boris Johnson's trip to Canada, and of course, more of us yapping about what's hot in politics right now. We want to make it as easy as possible for you to become a Canada Land supporter. So from now until the end of May, we have a special offer for our listeners. Sign up now for just $2 a month for the next 6 months. Just go to canadaland.com/join or click the link in your show notes to become a supporter today. Hey, it's Matea Roach, and this is The Backbench, a podcast about Canadian politics and why you just can't say anything anymore because of woke.
I had been monitoring the neo-Nazi movement since sort of the later years of my high school. The Heritage Front was at the time the largest neo-Nazi group in Canada and had been growing and causing a fair bit of problems in the Toronto area.
That's Richard Warman. He's a lawyer in Ottawa that spoke to Canada Land in 2017 after the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally. Remember that? Hundreds of white nationalists gathered at a rally over plans to remove a Confederate statue in Charlottesville. They were met by counter-protesters, one of whom was killed when a rally participant deliberately drove his Dodge Challenger into the crowd of counter-protesters.
Higher. Field seen here in 2017, speeding through that group of people, then erratically backing up.
But well before Charlottesville, in the early aughts, Richard used his legal prowess to go after neo-Nazi groups.
After I went to law school, I figured, well, okay, society has spent an awful lot of money educating me. I have some, moral obligation to pay back that and try to make the world a better place. So now that I have the historical and political knowledge of who these people are and what they're up to and the risks that they pose, now I'll put those legal skills that I have to use.
He used a relatively obscure piece of the Canadian Human Rights Act, Section 13. It was a law originally intended to make it unlawful to spread hate propaganda.
No, I mean, it always drove the neo-Nazis nuts because they couldn't figure out who I was and what I was up to because they didn't know who I was when I first started this human rights work. So when they finally got around to pictures of me, they were like, okay, well, that's a bit of a mind twist for them because he's white and he's male. So the only things that are really left for us is he must be gay and he must be Jewish. So my standard response to that has always been, look, I'm a Canadian citizen who just really doesn't like neo-Nazism.
Richard's work landed him humanitarian awards.
You come to an understanding that people think that when they're on the internet, they take the chains off and they let their inner demons free to run amok. And that they think somehow it's okay to talk about, you know, we need to drive these people out. That it's okay to post pictures of sniper rifles pointing at Justin Trudeau and say that he's responsible for all these members of the Muslim community coming into Canadian society. And therefore, we need to kill not just them, but him as well.
But the internet of 2005 looked nothing like the internet of today. So why are we talking about Richard Warman in 2024? The provision he used for these battles, Section 13 of the Human Rights Act, was repealed in 2014. So this mechanism doesn't even exist anymore, but it might be coming back. A couple of weeks ago, Liberal Justice Minister Arif Virani laid out legislation the government's been promising for years, a bill to eliminate harmful content on the internet, the Online Harms Act.
What I find troubling is that there's more rules for my son's Lego than there is for the most dangerous toy in my home and in every home in this country. And that toy is the screen that your child is on right now, whether that's a phone, a tablet, or a computer screen.
This is a huge piece of legislation consisting of a few parts that are loosely related to one another. So, firstly, the Online Harms Act would force online platforms to remove child pornography, revenge porn, and other extremely harmful onerous content within 24 hours. Great. I think we can all agree this is a really good step. Secondly, it would create a 5-member, quote, digital safety commission to enforce the new rules. Thirdly, the Online Harms Act would also create a new standalone hate crime, which could be applied to any offense of the criminal code in cases where the underlying cause or motivating factor for the offense is hate. It would raise penalties for hate propaganda offenses, so for instance, things like advocating or promoting genocide, to a maximum sentence of life imprisonment. And lastly, and this is the part I want to focus on, the new bill, the Online Harms Act, would amend the Canadian Human Rights Act to give people the ability to report hateful internet posts to the Canadian Human Rights Commission. This is why I was bringing up Richard Warman earlier. This is the sort of provision that he used in his work back in the aughts. And this has led to some criticism.
What does Justin Trudeau mean when he says the word hate speech? He means speech he hates.
So this is what we want to dig into today. The Canadian Human Rights Act amendment is not the biggest part of the Online Harms Act by any means, but it's an element that has drummed up a fair amount of scrutiny and opposition, and I think has also been a window into wider conversations about what sorts of speech are and aren't acceptable on the internet, whether the internet is a private or public space, and what free speech even means in the 2020s. The Liberals are essentially trying to revive old legislation that was repealed in 2014 by the Harper government. Free speech absolutists think that this part of the Online Harms Act would stem the free flow of discourse online, while advocates of this piece of the act say that it's a crucial step to protect targets of online hate. Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre says that online harm should be punished with the criminal courts, not pushed off to new bureaucracy. What was Section 13? Why was it repealed, and would it even work? How does this all fit into the new internet age? Because the internet has changed a lot since Section 13 was repealed in 2014. Our panelists today are Emily Laidlaw and Richard Moon. Emily's a Canada Research Chair in Cybersecurity Law and an Associate Professor at the University of Calgary. She was the co-chair of the government's Expert Advisory Group on Online Safety. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
And Richard's a law professor at the University of Windsor. His research focuses on freedom of expression, conscience, and religion. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's get into it. So, Richard, I want to turn to you first. We heard a bit from Richard Warman in the intro, and he in the past had used Section 13 laws in the early aughts to go after specifically neo-Nazis on the internet. So can you give me a layout of what the old Section 13 was and how he was able to use it? Because he was kind of the most prominent person, I think, to use that section of the act.
Yeah, I could begin by saying Richard was actually a student of mine and took a course I taught on freedom of expression, coincidentally, but went on to, gain some fame around this. Section 13 was added to the Canadian Human Rights Act before really the internet was a meaningful thing. And it was initially to respond to what was described in the legislation as telephonic communication. It came about in response to a very particular situation. There was an organization that the Western Guard that had established a hate phone line. You could call in for your weekly anti-Semitic hate message. And it was thought that for various reasons, the criminal code provision might not properly address this sort of situation. So this was part of the motivation for adding Section 13, the original version of Section 13, the Canadian Human Rights Act. Of course, subsequently, the internet came about, and long after that, social media came to play a large role. So the act was amended so that it included communication that was telephonic, but also internet communication. And the basic process is that an individual would make a complaint to the commission. The commission would investigate the complaint. An investigation involved seeking a response from the person about whom the complaint was made or the institution about whom the complaint was made, and then going back to the complainant, and then there would be an inquiry report written, and both parties would have an opportunity to respond to it. And if the commission decided that the complaint had real substance, they could refer the complaint then to the Canada Human Rights Tribunal to be adjudicated. So discrimination under the Canada Human Rights Act is broadly defined. And then we have added to it this particular provision that deals with hate speech. Now, I should say, I didn't mention that what the Section 13 prohibited was communication online that was likely to expose the members of groups defined on the grounds that were covered under the legislation to hatred. That was the basic test or the basic rule.
What would that look like if you have a human rights complaint brought against you? And I guess, like, just generally speaking, why did Section 13 get repealed? Because it was certainly controversial in its time.
I mean, I would say the first thing is the process put a huge burden on the complainant themselves. I mean, that's precisely why there were so few complaints, certainly very few complaints that went to adjudication before the tribunal, and why one person in particular was associated, because it was an enormous burden on that person. I mean, Richard Warman had death threats made against him. It was enormously costly and time-consuming for him to do. So it was actually really a huge burden on the complainant itself. One of my main concerns at the time about this particular provision was, we're talking about hate speech. We're talking about an activity that is extreme in character. Things like describing the members of the group as subhuman or as inherently violent or as a danger to our children, things of that kind. So we're talking about really extreme speech. And this whole process was not really well designed to deal with extreme speech in this way. The overall act is dealing with discrimination, broadly understood, where there may be no malice. And the idea that you would have an exchange, you might even be seeking conciliation with a neo-Nazi, you know, didn't really make a lot of sense as a process.
I know that you released a report about Section 13 back in 2008. Was this sort of reasoning that you're offering of the process not being particularly well designed to, I guess, provide a remedy for victims of hate speech specifically? Is that sort of what your rationale was for why it ought to be repealed and, I guess, presumably replaced with some sort of other remedy?
Well, I mean, I thought at the time that the appropriate response was probably the criminal code response. I mean, the criminal code, as you know, includes a prohibition on the willful promotion of hatred against members of groups defined on particular grounds. I should say about Section 13, there were very, very few complaints. In the period of time I studied, I think there were something like 36, 35 complaints, and only about 13 or 14 of them went to the tribunal. So if you're looking for something that was going to actually address hate speech as a problem online, this certainly wasn't doing it. When I wrote this report in 2008, social media was not a meaningful thing. And hate speech online, you know, existed in these obscure websites in the margins of kind of public conversation, or the margins of the internet. You wouldn't know about them if you didn't look for them. So again, that's a reason why I think there were probably so few complaints. Most people going about in their daily lives would never come across the kind of exchanges that were going on these particular websites. But now, of course, everything has changed. I mean, most activity online is taking place on different social media platforms. And hate speech certainly spreads more widely and more quickly on these different platforms. I mean, the other thing I should say is, again, Matteo, you mentioned that the Harper government had repealed Section 13 in 2014, but they didn't repeal it for any of the reasons I put forward. There was a whole disinformation campaign conducted by various right-wing sources that was just full of fabrications, you know, about the improper behavior or actions of the members of the commission, all kinds of false claims. And sadly, those really took hold and probably lay behind the decision to repeal, as opposed to what I thought, from my point of view, were the very practical, reasonable reasons why this might not be the best way to address hate speech.
I want to kind of turn to, I guess, the now as opposed to the history, because I think this is all very interesting context of sort of the backdrop of why this provision was removed from the Human Rights Act in the first place. But we might see it kind of come back in a somewhat different form. The internet is an incredibly different place, and sort of the average internet user's exposure to what I would describe as hateful content, I think, is much higher than it would have been at the time that this portion of the act was originally introduced and sort of applied to the internet. Certainly in kind of the Elon Musk era of Twitter, I feel like I see things constantly that are very upsetting and often seem like they're designed to foment hatred against particular groups. So I guess aside from the context of the internet's changed a lot, Emily, is there anything else that's notably different about this sort of language in the Human Rights Act this time around?
Yes. And I think that one of the key things is that the reintroduction of Section 13 is actually different language. It's much tighter language. It's now setting down that is communicating that detestation and vilification that is supposed to be that high standard for hate speech. The threshold is much higher. And there's also built into it that the commission can dismiss a complaint just on its face if it's evident that it's not hate speech. So the hope with that type of structure then is that only, you know, a few complaints are really then moving on to the tribunal process.
The proposal in the new bill says something like, if it's evident to them, this is not going to succeed. So it gives them a little more leeway to not have to proceed with an investigation that would pull, you know, a party into it when it's just not going to succeed.
One of the reasons that I've been generally supportive of some version of Section 13 being reintroduced, more, you know, and dealing with all the issues that Richard is talking about, and if we could deal with some of the administrative issues, is the fact that at the moment in law, the only thing available is to go to law enforcement, and the standard is so rightfully high for prosecution of hate crimes. And, you know, some victims don't want to go to the police. The resources of law enforcement is limited to deal with some of these issues. Under the criminal code, you can get an order for takedown of hate propaganda from social media platforms. But generally speaking, they're just dealing with it themselves. So there's nothing else for victims available to them, especially when it's outside the criminal context. And I think that there is, it's justified to be looking at something lesser than criminal law that might enable an individual to say, you know, there should be an order from a commission to that individual to take down content and to no longer post that type of content. And maybe in limited circumstances to impose, you know, fine or damages or however you want to frame it under the commission. Does this need to be tightly strung? Absolutely. But I think that there is a gap right now where there's very little available to Canadians.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not unsympathetic to that view, the idea that this could perform a supplemental role in the sense of giving individuals complaint and being able to focus on the particular parties who are engaging in what may be hate speech. But, you know, as you know, and has been talked about, I suppose my main concern is there's a lot of it out there. And any process, this is the main reason why we have the core of this law being involving a duty imposed upon platforms to act responsibly, come up with digital safety, you know, plans and so forth, is that the existing legal processes are just so cumbersome, so slow to be able to deal with this massive problem online. My main concern is that it seems to me it's going to go one way or the other. Either there are going to be so many complaints that the commission and perhaps the tribunal will just be absolutely overwhelmed. It just won't, it will break down. And then the process for a hearing and so forth will be so delayed, as is already a problem with many human rights code processes. Or in the alternative, if that doesn't happen, if it operates the way it did before, where there are really just a few complaints and a few complaints go to tribunal, the unfair accusation, but it was a common accusation under the old provision, was the commission is highly selective. It's focusing on only some groups rather than others. Now, that wasn't true because it was a complaint-driven process. The commission, you know, considered the complaints that they received. But I fear that if there's very few, it will be seen as something that is just operating in this selective way in relation to some groups rather than others, or some individuals rather than others. So that's my concern. Either it's going to get overwhelmed, or if it's not overwhelmed, it's not really going to be doing what it needs to do, and will in fact be accused of, and the commission will be accused of being highly selective or something along those lines.
You know, and it's funny because I entirely agree with you. I think there's such important points, and I don't think that we know, do we? And I, you know, reading through the structure of it, I thought, well, as much as I said, an order is important, be able to take that content down. I mean, how long would it take to get that? The period from that complaint to that hearing takes a long period of time. And so it's effectively not very useful. You're still then just ultimately dependent on those platforms.
My question then is, why this specific remedy now being introduced in this bill? Like, what is the sort of political calculus, I suppose, for the government to introduce this particular piece of the Online Harms Act at this time?
I mean, the Liberal government did indicate that they intended to reintroduce Section 13 or some version. In fact, the earlier Online Harms Bill, or whatever its formal title was, I mean, it was accompanied by a proposal to reintroduce Section 13. So this has been around for a while, and a number of groups were very unhappy with its repeal in 2014 and have, you know, continued to press the government for it. I mean, I sometimes feel like it's about optics. It's about appearance, in the same way that this bill makes available life imprisonment as at least the outer limit of a sentence for advocating genocide, for example, or for this new broad category of hate crimes. It really feels like it's more a matter of optics than it is of real practical law enforcement or practical way to address hate speech.
Every conversation that I've had with various, victim groups, right, and their representatives have talked, when they talk about harms, they're talking about it in a whole person and whole group perspective about the things that are happening to them and needing different tools available to them to try to address it. So, you know, we, from a legal perspective, it's important that we want to break this down to, okay, let's talk about what's appropriate in criminal law. Let's talk about human rights legislation and the different standards and effectiveness. But they're not really thinking about it that way. They're like, we just need to deal with these harms in a particular way. And so I think that push has been there for a long time to deal with it. And so, I mean, we have to see how this debate plays out. I'm sort of as interested as everyone else where this is going to land, because I think the Section 13 one is a difficult one to do effectively.
I mean, I think it's an unfortunate, really on both sides, have a kind of unrealistic or misleading picture of the history of Section 13. So on the one side, those who are really pressing for it have a really inflated view of its importance. It really, it came into public light, but it really was playing a very, very minor role in addressing hate speech online in particular. On the other hand, you made reference to different groups, church groups and others, who just consider it to be terrible and dangerous. And again, it wasn't those things. If anything, it wasn't doing very much at all. And again, as I say, all the cases that went to the tribunal and in which Section 13 was found to have been breached were all really extreme speech, and almost all involved calls for the death of members of a particular group. So unfortunately, I think there's a kind of weird mythology about Section 13 on both sides. And I fear that the kind of debate we're about to have will not be a well-informed debate. We already have one political leader saying things like, I'm against this bill, even before it's come out, and it's just going to be about what Justin Trudeau doesn't want you to say.
Basically, anybody who disagrees with his radical agenda when it comes to kids, he says, is hate speech. Go down the list of things that Justin Trudeau disapproves of, and you can imagine all of the things that will be criminalized.
You're thinking, are you kidding me? I mean, this is just so ignorant, but it has the potential of feeding the fears and anxieties of some out there. And it's really, really frustrating and troubling.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Some of the examples that I've seen in sort of public discourse and discussion about this, I think have really been, I guess, like playing by the exact playbook that you've described of like both sides sort of imagining Section 13 to be much more powerful and significant than perhaps it really was. Not to downplay the fact that it is really important that we have mechanisms through which online hate can be addressed. Some of the criticism that I've been seeing about these Human Rights Act provisions came in the form of this opinion piece that was in the National Post recently, and a quote from it goes as follows. It is distressingly easy to imagine scenarios where everyday political speech finds itself under the purview of the Canadian Human Rights Commission. Criticizing Hamas and the murderous ideology that motivates it could, to some, be seen as, quote, likely to foment detestation or vilification, end quote, against a group, especially if the condemnation of Hamas notes that Palestinians generally support the terrorist group or that Hamas is driven by religious fanaticism. This to me seems quite obviously like fear-mongering, because when, Richard, when you're bringing up examples of the sort of extremity of language that in the past led to successful complaints being filed, it all is very much more extreme than that. What do you make of the argument that there's going to be a chilling effect on speech that doesn't meet that high threshold?
Yeah, and I mean, certainly that chilling effects argument is sort of one of the first ones that's made, right? And so I have a few points to make about chilling effects. That first, the whole point of any sort of law against speech, whether you're talking about hate speech or you're talking about fraud or you're talking about defamation, the whole point is to chill certain types of speech that are seen as illegal. I mean, that is the point of it, right? So there's two things that flow from that. One is that you don't want to chill then sort of the discourse in the gray areas. And that's why keeping that standard really high in law is incredibly important. But, you know, I've mentioned before that Europe has a notice and takedown provision for social media when it comes to hate speech and the risks that has, you know, there are concerns that over-incentivizes and chills speech. And that is a concern. And I think a notable thing here is that the Canadian government has actually proposed something that, you know, might actually be criticized by victims groups as not going far enough of not chilling enough speech because of the fact that it doesn't result in the removal of that speech. I don't think that the prospect of Section 13 it's going to chill speech in any way. And I don't think that the proposed platform rules are going to chill that. But the other point I wanted to make is that speech is being chilled right now anyway. And John Penny's done empirical work on this where there's all kinds of people, in particular, racialized, marginalized groups. I mean, if you're intersectional, it's the worst for you, that you are chilled from participating in these speeches online because they're such toxic, horrible places for you to be. So that chilling effect is happening to others. And sometimes they talk about it as just this idea of free speech elitism, right? So when we talk about freedom of expression, it's also about how do you just, you know, target the worst forms of speech, but also try to actually facilitate better spaces that include everybody.
Yeah, no, I agree. There is certainly a difference between the legal definition of hate speech and popular views or understandings of it, and the terms thrown around often very freely in relation to speech that somebody feels uncomfortable with or feels hurt by in some way. I mean, one of the challenges with hate speech law generally is we are trying to distinguish, isolate the extreme from the more commonplace forms of bigoted speech that exist everywhere. And we know that as a practical matter, law can't address. It just is not imaginable that you could somehow cleanse public discourse of all stereotypes, of all bigoted thinking and so forth. So there's always going to be a line that's drawn between the extreme and the more commonplace. And that's a challenge. And chilling effect is something that, you know, is often made reference to. I might say that sometimes the speech that might be chilled is speech that might be bigoted in character anyway. But with that said, the concerns always expressed about line drawing here is that the line may be drawn in the wrong place and the law might catch speech that should be lawful and shouldn't be prohibited. Or even if the line's drawn in the right place, even if the courts or tribunals get it right, nevertheless, individuals may not be totally sure or confident that their speech won't be caught by this law, and so they are discouraged from engaging in that speech. That's the kind of classic American jurisprudence chilling effect argument.
You know, but we're talking about, like, online content, right? It's not sort of as simple as, like, you're holding a rally and you're speaking in the town square. Like, I think a lot of our understanding of what speech is hasn't really, like, caught up to the fact that so much of speech and so much of discourse happens online. Like, you know, a post on a platform that's public, I think pretty clearly, if it meets the sort of high threshold for hate speech, could constitute something that you could take to the Human Rights Tribunal. I guess, like, does this also capture things like YouTube videos, like live streams? I know, for instance, in the case of the Christchurch mosque shooting, that was live streamed. And certainly, you know, not only was it capturing acts of violence, but also speech acts as well. What about, like, private messages, right? I think that that's, like, an area where a lot of people who are targeted by hate speech receive sort of the most hateful vitriolic content in DMs or emails. Like, is that – what sorts of, I guess, methods of communication within the realm of online communication get captured by this law?
You know, there's a legitimate point of discussion here about what should be in scope and out of scope, because they're only focused on social media services where content is being posted publicly and it is capable of being published to an unlimited audience. Right. So that means, and they are clear, private messaging is out entirely. And that means that for certain messaging services, like Telegram, if it's channels that are to an unlimited group, it would be covered, but not ones that are closed groups. So it has an interesting dynamic. And across the board, I mean, I would say it's not even just hate speech, but we're also talking about radicalization, right? So many of these, you know, real world attacks that we know about, you're thinking of Manassian, who is, you know, has openly said that he was radicalized online and in cell groups. The Christchurch attack, the London attack, all these individuals were participating in spaces that some were private messaging groups, right? Some were public. And you know, I know we're not going beyond that to things like child luring and sextortion, but, you know, so many of the horrific cases that we know about there are also happening in private messaging on Snapchat. So only a part of this is actually being captured by this law. I think there's a scoping problem.
Clearly what's going on is there are concerns about the state becoming too deeply involved in private conversation. Even though, obviously, if one of our concerns about hate speech is encouraging individuals to engage in extreme or radical action, we could well be concerned about what goes on more privately in, you know, in exchanges of hateful views among individuals who are like-minded in some way. But the constraint, really, I think, is that we don't want the state to get too involved in what is private.
I want to get into almost some kind of like specific, I guess, examples of sorts of speech that I think exists kind of on the line of like whether or not it would be something that the Human Rights Tribunal might want to address or whether or not. And I guess just as a thought experiment, my producer, Sam, pulled up some examples of hateful messages. The first couple come actually from like the Twitter terms of service. So it's hypothetical examples, not like real tweets. And I guess I'm not asking for like a yes or no answer of
good.
Would the Human Rights Tribunal, you know, you're on the Human Rights Tribunal. Are you going to, you know, say, yes, this is hate speech. And if you tweeted this, you get a fine. But just as kind of a thought experiment, like, what do you think the sort of conversation around some of these would be? So from the Twitter terms of service, the examples that they list of hateful speech are all bracket age group. So they're kind of asking you to fill in the blank of what sort of group you think might be targeted. All age group are leeches and don't deserve any support from us. People with blank disease are rats that contaminate everyone around them. People with blank disability are subhuman and shouldn't be seen in public. Blank religious groups should be punished. We are not doing enough to rid us of those filthy animals. Like, this kind of language. And I think you can imagine, like, the sorts of groups that people would fill in. Very classic kind of, like, dehumanizing type of language. Not exactly escalating to calls for violence, but still quite bad. It's also written in a way that is not reflective of how people talk online. What are your thoughts about how the Online Harms Act would respond to this sort of content?
Well, without saying exactly how the act would respond to it, I think that, you know, most of the examples you gave would probably count as extreme speech, but it's also hard to think or talk about them in the abstract, in the sense of leaving out the name of a group. Good reason not to do that in this particular interview, of course, to not include it in this interview. But part of what we think about when we think about hate speech is a pattern of bigotry, discrimination, hatred, and so forth. And so, you know, it's what makes a swastika significant. It's not just that somehow it appeared out of nowhere and somebody used it in a particular way with something in mind. It is as a whole history drenched in violence that plays a role in how we understand this. So when you read examples about a group, somebody being subhuman, it's always going to be tied up with a kind of history or pattern of treating and regarding the members of a group in that way. And that is an important part of how we understand and experience hate speech, for example. So I think it's important to recognize that. And I appreciate that the new version of Section 13, the proposed version, does include language in relation to context, for example.
Yeah, and when you speak about context, there's both sort of the historical context of certain kinds of language having been used over a long period of time in reference to certain groups, having been used perhaps to foment support for, like, actual atrocities that have been committed against those groups, like violence. And then I think there's also the context of perhaps an individual user's history of using language. Because often, like, when I see, you know, I've had some, like, gnarly stuff. I mostly turn off my replies on Twitter now because, like, I don't care what people have to say. I turn off my replies except for people I follow. Those are the people where I really care what they have to say. But, you know, back in the day when I used to let anybody reply to me, there would be some, like, really gnarly homophobic comments in my Twitter replies. And if you went to those people's profiles, often they would be making those sorts of comments repeatedly in my replies, in the replies of other prominent lesbians. And it's sort of the context of an individual's evidence of hatred towards a certain group. So I guess, are you referring to the historical, the personal, or both when you're talking about context?
I think all of the above. I think that, you know, an important part of context is what's going on around in the world and how, to whom this is being directed. And all of those are all going to be factors, I think, that ought to be taken into account in making the judgment. I mean, sometimes it's kind of clear and it's straightforward. And most of the things you cited are pretty extreme in character. And how I would sometimes, you know, talk about what counts as extreme, not that it necessarily involves an explicit call for violence against the members of this group, but that if you were to take seriously what is being claimed or said about the members of the group, you'd have to think that some kind of extreme action was appropriate or justified in relation to that group, whether that was violence or exclusion from society or whatever it might be. So it doesn't have to be explicit. It can be implicit in the message.
I noticed how you said, oh, these are such extreme examples. It's not how people talk online. And I think that that is one of the challenges, isn't it? That so much of that hate, sometimes it's explicit and sometimes it's more intentionally coded. And we see it with the memes and we're seeing it with Hong Kong for anti-Semitism, you know, for the Heil Hitler and different ways that they just certain words start meaning certain things. And I think that that's so hard to pin down. I mean, the context matters, much more difficult, I think, to take on in terms of against individuals under the Human Rights Act or Criminal Code. But this is where I think that focus on the systemic risk of harm and duty to act responsibly on platforms ends up being so important, because it's not about the individual pieces of content. It's about that's the steady stream of it. And from a consumer perspective, is that company, they have to show, they have to demonstrate to a regulator that certain steps are being taken.
I think it's interesting, Emily, you brought up this issue of codedness of language and that making it difficult to adjudicate in certain cases what the intent behind a post was. I think there's like a great degree of literacy, unfortunately, that's required to parse in a lot of cases, like some of the most hateful content online, because it's using like metaphors that the average person just simply isn't familiar with. I want to read from, and this is from an email, so obviously it would be out of scope because it's a personal communication. And to the extent that like you could do anything about it, it would probably be like an issue of criminal harassment, maybe. We've spoken a little bit about how marginalized groups specifically are targeted and are often prevented from really accessing, I would say, their full free speech rights. Just by the fact that like the space of public discourse can be so toxic and so noxious for them, there's been a pattern of, and this thankfully hasn't happened to me, but of racialized journalists, women who work in journalism, being targeted by just like really aggressive and coordinated groups of hate mongers, I'll say. So one email that was publicly circulated that was sent to a racialized woman working in journalism basically started off using a bunch of racial slurs, referring to women as cunts and bitches. So targeting female journalists because of race and because of gender. And basically it goes on in this email that I'm going to read an excerpt from. There's sort of an implied rape threat, I think, but it sort of falls into this territory of it's implicit. So the email reads, after rating which ones, referring to female journalists, need to be silenced first, which seems violent, and which one's retired, etc. Well, after a few beers, the boys got to rating which one of you activist bitches they'd most like to make love to in a romantic, consenting way. Drum roll, dot, 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 you rated the highest. Now, it is an email, and so again, like I said, it's out of scope for that reason. But this sort of content that isn't as explicit, is the use of slurs enough that this is something that someone would be able to take to the Human Rights Tribunal under Section 13? Like, I guess, what are your thoughts about this sort of content online? Because this is like the sort of thing that I feel like I tend to see in people's replies on Twitter, unfortunately, quite frequently.
So I'd actually say that's the perfect example of one of the most challenging issues. I think I don't know about the Human Rights Commission. I am curious what Richard has to say about that. So I'll just comment on the platform regulation dimension of this. I think that there's some scope here with the way the legislation is written that the individual would have to have some access to be able to report this kind of content, that the platform would have to have processes in place to be able to deal with that. I think it's generally captured by the, you know, fomenting hatred and incitement to violence loosely. I mean, you're looking at a systemic level here. We're not talking about the criminal code. It perhaps is captured by that. This is something that a digital safety commission, though, a lot of this is left to regulation. So when they say what should be in your digital safety plan, what should you be addressing? It will be addressed there. Again, though, that individual journalist who has faced this, that is just, they're still left with a platform and an ombudsperson. And otherwise, you're going to a human rights commissioner.
Depending on how you understand it, but I think most of us understand what was said here in a particular way, it would constitute a kind of threat. Would it meet the requirements under the criminal code for threat? Maybe. I mean, I'm not a criminal lawyer, and it's hard for me to know. It's obviously gendered. There's no question about that. And it's obviously hateful. You know, to take, though, a kind of implicit threat or, at minimum, denigrating speech about a particular individual, then it becomes a question of, well, can we call this hate speech on the grounds of gender? Maybe, but it's not so simple, since it's not making, at least explicitly, a claim more generally about women. It is a claim about this person and apparently a threat directed at this person. So it doesn't fit in a tidy way, I think, within the kind of scope of a hate speech provision under, say, the Human Rights Code.
Well, thank you for participating in this thought experiment with me. What I want to do in closing, I know both of you have a lot of general thoughts about this bill, not just about the Human Rights Act provisions, but about the Online Harms Act more broadly. Is there anything else you want to leave as a takeaway for our listeners before we wrap up our conversation?
I think that, you know, the primary focus of this new bill is on the idea that social media companies have certain responsibilities. And I think that one thing that's important for listeners to understand is that we are operating in a relative legal vacuum in Canada in this space. There's obligations for dealing with content in a particular way when you're talking about copyright, when you're talking about defamation, but there aren't minimum standards on these companies or consumer protection laws that say how they should be managing the safety of their products and services that they've designed, how they're managing moderation of that content. And so we need some law like this, and it in fact would bring us in line with global regulators. There is a very important conversation to be had, though, about whether it achieves the right balance. For example, I think that if you're going to put safety obligations on social media companies, they should also have obligations. Safety also includes freedom of expression. It includes the right to privacy. So they should have obligations to account for that in the way that, you know, an account to a regulator and say, you know, these are the steps I took with our service in balancing out these particular issues. And I think they could go further with that. You could parse the legislation, and that's why the broader discussion we should be having is not this is a censorship bill or this is just about protecting children. It's about every provision in this and ensuring that it's getting that balance right, because some of this is about technical solutions by companies that content's going viral. There's some like basically just stopping point that, you know, you can complain easily, that there's due process, that they, you know, a million, all these things that require that kind of fine-grained analysis.
My concern is that peripheral parts of this bill, like Section 13 and so forth, will distract us from what really is the important core that Emily's referring to, and that is the duty upon platforms to behave in a responsible way with engagement and oversight by a government agency. I think it's important. I think it's necessary. I think that we're at a point where we do recognize that traditional legal responses just can't do it. They just can't address what's going on online. And that's why I think this is a really, really important response. And I just hope that the criticism of these peripheral elements don't detract from, you know, the importance of this, the core of this bill.
Thank you so much, both of you, for participating in some of the demystification of, I guess, the more distracting elements of the bill, the sort of things that are taking up public oxygen and are kind of, you know, not really, I guess, at the core of what's going to help make the internet a less terrible place, but are still important to talk about. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
So one thing I learned in the course of my conversation with Richard and Emily is that I will actually not be able to take any of the people who have tweeted bananas things about me or to me to the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. My personal favorite weird tweet that's ever been made about me was the following. Canadian girl on Jeopardy with the most magnificent rack, natural beauty and matronly, but the septum piercing and awful worldview killed it. Feminism must be abolished. So this guy will not be seeing a tribunal, at least not because of anything he said about me online. It's not really advocating harm towards a group. I certainly think it's rooted in an ideology that's quite troubling, in the sense of feminism must be abolished, certainly says some things about what you think about women. But although it's weird and off-putting, it's mostly, to me, kind of funny. And in that, I really do feel incredibly lucky. I have yet to directly experience the worst the internet has to offer in terms of online hate directed towards me specifically. But I have noticed content online becoming a bit more bonkers, a bit more vitriolic, and people generally seeming freer to express really, really destructive and noxious sentiments towards all kinds of groups. If the Online Harms Act passes in its current form, if we see Section 13-like provisions added back to the Canadian Human Rights Act, who knows if we're going to see someone take up the mantle that Richard Warman took up all those years ago and try and really target some of this content that's just currently kind of being allowed to spread unchecked on many social media platforms. It seems overwhelming, just the amount of hateful speech that exists online. It seems like a problem that almost feels too big to tackle. It's unclear whose responsibility it is. But what we saw back in the early aughts with Richard Warman is this targeted approach to dealing with neo-Nazi publishers, to dealing with online hate speech that was of the worst, most vitriolic, most destructive kind, particularly anti-Semitism. And it seems as though, through his efforts, he made some dent in online hate speech.
None of the individuals that I filed complaints against continue to be active in breaching the law. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, there are only two of them who are still involved in the neo-Nazi movement, and they have both rectified or remedied their conduct so that they are no longer engaged in disseminating unlawful hate propaganda. When you look at it, it basically set the movement back in Canada.
It remains to be seen whether the Online Harms Act in general or the Human Rights Code provisions in it specifically are going to have a similar impact on hateful speech online. I think certainly we would all stand to benefit from living in a society where the internet is not an incredibly toxic and, like, just unpleasant place to be as a member of a marginalized group. And I'm interested to see what happens from here. All right, let's adjourn. That's been The Backbench. We'll talk again in 2 weeks when it will officially be spring. Finally. Seasonal affective disorder found dead. It's going to be light so late in the evening. It's going to rock. Let us know what you're pissed off about, what you've been watching closely, and what you want to hear us discuss in the world of Canadian politics. Send us your questions, your concerns, and your rants. You can email us at backbench@canadaland.com, and you can also DM us on Twitter @backbenchcast. I'm Matea Roach, and you can find me @MateaRoach on Twitter and Instagram. You can find Richard Moon @Richard_Moon, and you can find Emily Laidlaw @EmilyLaidlaw. The first tweet on Twitter was made 18 years ago at 3:50 p.m., March 21st, 2006. Twitter's co-founder Jack Dorsey posted, "Just setting up my Twitter," spelled T-W-T-T-R, no vowels. The internet was different back then. This episode was produced by Aviva Lessard and Sam Connert, with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production coordinator is Andre Prou. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Theme music is by Nathan Burley. If you value this podcast, support us. You'll get premium access to all our shows ad-free, including early releases and bonus content. You'll also get our exclusive newsletter, discounts on merch, tickets to our live and virtual events, and more than anything, you'll be a part of the solution to Canada's journalism crisis by keeping our work free and accessible to everybody. You can listen ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. Thank you for listening. Hey, it's Matea, reminding you that this show cannot be made without you. If you've been thinking about becoming a Canada Land supporter, we're having a pretty great sale right now. You'll get premium ad-free feeds of all Canada Land shows, discounts on merch from our store, and exclusive bonus episodes, like a behind-the-scenes tour of the federal budget lockup, more of Boris Johnson's trip to Canada, and of course, more of us yapping about what's hot in politics right now. We want to make it as easy as possible for you to become a Canada Land supporter. So from now until the end of May, we have a special offer for our listeners. Sign up now for just $2 a month for the next 6 months. Just go to canadaland.com/join or click the link in your show notes to become a supporter today.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again. Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Listen up, true crime fans.
There's a big murder trial underway.
Dateline is launching a new podcast with Andrea Canning.
Welcome to Dateline True Crime Weekly.
We'll cover breaking crime news around the country with the best reporters on the case, NBC News analysts, and Dateline producers on the ground.
Over. Break it down for us.
You'll just get behind-the-scenes scoops from crime scenes to courtrooms.
So tell us what he said.
Listen to Dateline True Crime Weekly now and catch new episodes every Thursday.
Wherever you get your podcasts.